Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
This is Protecting Project Pulp, episode 90. I'm your host, Simon Hildebrandt. Welcome to the show. This week we bring you Spawn of Dagon by Henry Kuttner, narrated by James Silverstein. We've run stories by Henry Kuttner twice before, in episodes 16 and 74 to be exact, so I'll just give you a very quick bio. He's an American author of science fiction, fantasy and horror, born in Los Angeles, California in 1915. He became a friend of Clark Ashton Smith and H.P. Lovecraft, and contributed several stories to the Cthulhu mythos. Kuttner married C.L. Moore, another pulp author, in 1940, and often collaborated with her under various pseudonyms. He died of a heart attack in Los Angeles in 1958. James Silverstein has been creating worlds from words his whole life. After he received a book on the Roman Pantheon at age 6, he began forging his own mythos and stories. He also fell in love with movies and the classic world of movie theatres. At 9 he was given a basic Dungeons and Dragons book and found the wonders of creating adventures he could share with others. He later majored in film in order to participate in the world of cinema that he'd loved since he was young. However, he found that screenwriting doesn't provide the depth of colour that straight storytelling held, but he soon found opportunities for writing in the world of role-playing games, which had always been part of his life. He contributed to The Rapier's Edge for 7th Sea and False Gods for the Stargate SG-1 RPG. He's currently writing for the upcoming fantasy RPG Khan. James continues to embrace shared storytelling through acting and singing with his local community theatre. His gift for writing is, ironically, his curse in the world of gaming. He never gets to play because everyone wants to share in his imagination. So let's get right to it. This is Spawn of Dagon by Henry Kuttner, narrated by James Silverstein.
Two streams of blood trickled slowly across the rough boards of the floor. One of them emerged from a gaping wound in the throat of a prostrate, armor-clad body. The other dripped from a chink in the battered cuirass, and the swaying light of a hanging lamp cast grotesque shadows over the corpse and the two men who crouched on their hams watching it. They were both very drunk. One of them, a tall, extremely slender man whose bronzed body seemed boneless, so supple was it, murmured, "I win, Lycan. The blood wavers strangely, but the stream I split will reach this crack first." He indicated a space between the two planks with the point of his rapier. Lycan's childlike eyes widened in astonishment. He was short, thickly set, with a remarkably simian face set atop his broad shoulders. He swayed slightly as he gasped, "By Ishtar, the blood runs uphill!" Alec, the slender man, chuckled. "After all the mead you swilled, the ocean might run uphill. Well, the wager's won. I get the loot." He got up and stepped over to the dead man. Swiftly he searched him and suddenly muttered an explosive curse. "The swine's as bare as a Bacchic vestal. He has no purse." Lycan smiled broadly and looked more than ever like an undersized hairless ape. "The gods watch over me," he said in satisfaction. "Of all the millions in Atlantis, you had to pick a fight with a pauper," Alec groaned. "Now we'll have to flee San Mu, as your quarrels have forced us to flee Poseidna and Cornac. And San Mu mead is the best in the land. If you had to cause us trouble, why not choose a fat usurer? We'd have been paid for our trouble then, at least." "The gods watch over me," Lycan reiterated, leaning forward and then rocking back, chuckling to himself. He leaned too far and fell on his nose, where he remained without moving. Something dropped from the bosom of his tunic and fell with a metallic sound to the oaken floor. Lycan snored. Alec, smiling unpleasantly, appropriated the purse and investigated its contents. "Your fingers are swifter than mine," he told the recumbent Lycan. "But I can hold more mead than you. Next time, don't try to cheat one who has more brains in his big toe than you have in all your misshapen body. Scavenging little ape. Get up. The innkeeper is returning with soldiers." He thrust the purse into the wallet at his belt and kicked Lycan heartily, but the small thief failed to awaken. Cursing with a will, Elek hoisted the body of the other to his shoulders and staggered towards the back of the tavern. The distant sound of shouting from the street outside grew louder, and Elek thought he could hear the querulous complaints of the innkeeper. "There will be a reckoning, Lycan," he promised bitterly. "Ishtar, yes, you'll learn." He pushed through a golden drapery and hurried along a corridor, kicked open an oaken door, and came out into the alley behind the tavern. Above, cold stars glittered frostily, and an icy wind blew on Alec's sweating face, sobering him somewhat. Lycan stirred and writhed in his arms. "More grog," he muttered. "Oh, gods, is there no more grog?" A maudlin tear fell hotly on Alec's neck, and the latter for a moment entertained the not unpleasant idea of dropping Lycan and leaving him for the irate guards. The soldiers of San Mu were not renowned for their soft-heartedness, and tales of what they sometimes did to their captives were unpleasantly explicit. However, he ran along the alley instead, blundered into a brawny form that sprang out of the darkness abruptly, and saw a snarling, bearded face, indistinct in the vague starlight. He dropped Lycan and whipped out his rapier. Already the soldier was plunging forward, his greatsword rushing down. Then it happened. Alec saw the guard's mouth open in a square of amazement, saw horror spring into the cold eyes. The man's face was a mask of abysmal fear. He flung himself back desperately. The sword tip just missed Alec's face. The soldier raced away into the shadows. With a snake-like movement, Alec turned, rapier ready. He caught a blur of swift motion. The man facing him had lifted quick hands to his face and dropped them just as suddenly. But there was no menace in the gesture. Nevertheless, Alec felt a chill of inexplicable uneasiness crawl down his back as he faced his rescuer. The soldiers of San Mu were courageous, if lacking in human kindness. What had frightened the attacking guard? He eyed the other. He saw a medium-sized man clad in voluminous gray garments that were almost invisible in the gloom, saw a white face with regular, statuesque features. A black hollow sprang into existence within the white mask as a soft voice whispered, "You'd escaped from the guards? No need for your rapier. I'm a friend." But there's no time for talk. Thanks, and goodbye. Alec stooped and hoisted Lycan to his shoulders again. The little man was blinking and murmuring soft appeals for more mead, and the hasty thunder of mailed feet grew louder, while torchlight swiftly approaching cast gleams about the trio. "In here," the gray-clad man whispered, "you'll be safe." Now Alec saw that in the stone wall behind him a black rectangle gaped. He sprang through the portal without hesitation. The other followed, and instantly they were in utter blackness as an unseen door swung creakingly on rusted hinges. Alec felt a soft hand touch his own, or was it a hand? For a second he had the incredible feeling the thing whose flesh he had touched did not belong to any human body. It was too soft, too cold. His skin crawled at the feel of the thing. It was withdrawn, and a fold of gray cloth swung against his palm. He gripped it. "Follow." Silently gripping the guide's garment, bearing Lycan on his shoulders, Alec moved forward. How the other could find his way through the blackness, Alec did not know, unless he knew the way by heart. Yet the passage, if passage it was, turned and twisted endlessly as it went down. Presently, Alec had the feeling that he was moving through a larger space, a cave, perhaps. His footsteps sounded differently somehow, and through the darkness vague whisperings came to him. Whispers in no language he knew. The murmurous sibilants rustled out strangely, making Alec's brows contract and his free hand go involuntarily to the hilt of his rapier. He snarled, "Who's here?" The invisible guide cried out in the mysterious tongue. Instantly, the whispering stopped. "You are among friends," a voice said softly from the blackness. "We are almost at our destination. A few more steps." A few more steps, and light blazed up. They stood in a small rectangular chamber hollowed out of the rock. The nitrous walls gleamed dankly in the glow of an oil lamp, and a little stream ran across the rock floor of the cave and lost itself amidst chuckles of goblin laughter in a small hole at the base of the wall. Two doors were visible. The gray-clad man was closing one of them. A crude table and a few chairs were all the furnishings of the room. Alex strained his ears. He heard something. Something that should not be heard in Inland San Mu. He could not be mistaken. The sound of waves lapping softly in the distance, and occasionally a roaring crash as of breakers smashing on a rocky shore. He dumped Lycan unceremoniously on one of the chairs. The little man fell forward on the table, pillowing his head in his arms. Sadly, he muttered, "Is there no more mead in Atlantis? I die, Alec. My belly is an arid desert across which the armies of Eblis march." He sobbed unhappily for a moment and fell asleep. Alec ostentatiously unsheathed his rapier and laid it on the table. His slender fingers closed on the hilt. "An explanation," he said, "is due. Where are we?" "I am Jesty," said the gray-clad one. His face seemed chalk-white in the light of the oil lamp. His eyes, deeply sunken, were covered with a curious glaze. "I saved you from the guards, eh? You'll not deny that." "You have my thanks," Alec said.
"Well?"
"I need the aid of a brave man, and I'll pay well. If you're interested, good. If not, I'll see you leave San Mu safely." Alec considered. "It's true we have little money." He thought of the purse in his wallet and grinned wryly. "Not enough to last long, at any rate. Perhaps we're interested, although..." He hesitated.
"Well?"
"I could bear to know how you got rid of that soldier so quickly back in the alley behind the tavern."
"I do not think that matters," Jesty whispered in his sibilant voice. "The guards are superstitious, and it is easy to play on their weakness. Let that suffice."
The cold glazed eyes met Elix squarely, and a little warning note seemed to clang into his brain. There was danger here. Yet danger had seldom given him pause. He said,
"What will you pay?"
1,000 gold pieces.
50,000 cups of mead," Lycan muttered sleepily. "Accept it, Elak. I'll await you here."
There was little affection in the glance Alec cast at his companion. "You'll get none of it," he promised. "Not a gold piece." He turned to Jesty.
"What's to be done for this reward?"
Jesty's immobile face watched him cryptically.
"Kill Zend."
Alec said, "Kill Zend?
Zend? The Wizard of Atlantis?"
"Are you afraid?"
Jesty asked tonelessly.
"I am," Lycan said without lifting his head from his arms. "However, if Alec is not, he may slay Zend and I'll wait here."
Ignoring him, Alec said, "I've heard strange things of Zend. His powers are not human. Indeed, he has not been seen in the streets of San Mu for 10 years. Men say he's immortal."
"Men are fools."
And in Jesty's voice, there was a contempt that made Alec stare at him sharply. It was as though Jesty was commenting on some race alien to him. The gray-clad man went on hurriedly, as though sensing the trend of Alec's thoughts.
"We have driven a passage under Zen's palace. We can break through at any time. That we shall do tonight. 2 tasks I give you. Kill Zend, shatter the Red Sphere."
Alec said, "You're cryptic." "What Red Sphere?"
"It lies in the topmost minaret of his palace. His magic comes from it. There is rich loot in the palace, Alec. If that is your name, so the little man called you."
"Alec or dunce or robber of drunken men,"
Lycan said, absently feeling the bosom of his tunic.
"All alike. Call him by any of those names and you'll be right. Where's my gold, Alec?"
But without waiting for an answer, he slumped down in his chair, his eyes closing and his mouth dropping open as he snored. Presently, he fell off the chair and rolled under the table, where he slumbered. "What the devil can I do with him?" Alec asked. "I can't take him with me. He'd leave him here," Jesty said. Alec's cold eyes probed the other. "He'll be safe?" "Quite safe. None in San Mu but our band knows of this underground way." "What band is that?" Alec asked. Jesty said nothing for a time. Then his soft voice whispered, "Need you know? A political group banded together to overthrow the king of San Mu and Zend, from whom he gets his power. Have you more questions?" "No." "Then follow." Jesty led Alec to one of the oaken doors. It swung open, and they moved forward up in a winding passage. In the dark, Alec stumbled over a step. He felt the cloth of Jesty's garment touch his hand and gripped it. In the blackness, they ascended a staircase out of the rock. Halfway up, Jesty paused. "I can go no further," he whispered. "The way is straight. At the end of the stairway, there is a trapdoor of stone. Open it. You'll be in Zen's place. Here's a weapon for you." He thrust a tube of cold metal into Alec's hand. "Simply squeeze its side, pointing the smaller end at Zend. You understand?" Alec nodded, and although Jesty could scarcely have seen the movement in the darkness, he whispered, "Good. Dagon guard you." He turned away. Alec heard the soft rush of his descent dying in the distance. He began to mount the stairs wonderingly. Dagon. Was Jesty a worshipper of the forbidden evil god of ocean? Poseidon, a benign sea god, was adored in marble temples all over the land, but the dark worship of Dagon had been banned for generations. There were tales of another race whose god Dagon was, a race that had not sprung from human or even earthly loins. Gripping the odd weapon, Alec felt his way upward. At length his head banged painfully against stone, and, cursing softly, he felt about in the darkness. It was the trapdoor of which Jesty had spoken. Two bolts slid back in well-oiled grooves, and the door lifted easily as Alec thrust his shoulders against it. He clambered up in semi-darkness, finding himself in a small bare room through which light filtered from a narrow window slit high in the wall. A mouse, squeaking fearfully, fled as he scrambled to his feet. Apparently the room was little used. Alec moved stealthily to the door. It swung open a little under his cautious hand. A corridor stretched before him, dimly lit by cold blue radiance that came from tiny gems set in the ceiling at intervals. Alec followed the upward slant of the passage. The red sphere Jesty had mentioned was in the topmost minaret. Up, then. In a niche in the wall, Alec saw the head. The shock of it turned him cold with amazement. A bodiless head set upright on a golden pedestal within a little alcove, its cheeks sunken, hair lank and disheveled, but eyes bright with incredible life. Those eyes watched him. "Ishtar," Alec breathed. "What wizardry's this?" He soon found out. The pallid lips of the horror writhed and twisted, and from them came a high, skirling cry of warning. "Zend! Zend! A stranger walks your—" Alec's rapier flew. There was scarcely any blood. He dragged the blade from the eye socket, whispering prayers to all the gods and goddesses he could remember. The lean jaw dropped, and a blackened and swollen tongue lolled from between the teeth. A red, shrunken eyelid dropped over the eye Alec had not pierced. There was no sound save for Alec's hastened breathing. He eyed the monstrous thing in the alcove, and then, confident that it was no longer a menace, lengthened his steps up the passage. Had Zend heard the warnings of his sentinel? If so, danger lurked all about him. A silver curtain slashed with a black pattern hung across the corridor. Alec parted it, and, watching, he froze every muscle. A dwarf, no more than 4 feet tall, with a disproportionately large head and a gray, wrinkled skin, was trotting briskly towards him. From the tales he had heard, Elek imagined the dwarf to be Zend. Behind the wizard strode a half-naked giant, who carried over his shoulder the limp form of a girl. Elek spun about, realizing he had delayed too long. Zen was parting the silver curtain as Elek raced back down the corridor. At his side, a black rectangle loomed, a passage he had overlooked, apparently, when he had passed it before. He sprang into its shielding darkness. When Zen passed, he would strike down the wizard and take his chances with the giant. Remembering the smooth, hard muscles that had rippled under the dead white skin of the man, Elek was not so sure his chances would be worth much. He realized now the giant had seemed familiar. Then he knew. 2 days ago he had seen a man, a condemned criminal, beheaded in the Temple of Poseidon. There could be no mistake. The giant was the same man, brought back to life by Zen's evil necromancy. "Ishtar," Elek whispered, sweating. "I'd be better off in the hands of the guards. How could he slay a man who was already dead?" Elek hesitated, his rapier half-drawn. There was no use borrowing trouble. He would keep safely out of sight until Zen was separated from his ghastly servitor, and then it would be an easy matter to put 6 inches of steel through the wizard's body. Elek was never one for taking unnecessary risks, as he had a wholesome regard for his own hide. He heard a shuffling of feet and drew back within the side passage to let Zend pass. But the wizard turned suddenly and began to mount the steeply sloping corridor where Elek lurked. In Zend's hand was a softly glowing gem that illuminated the passage, though not brightly. Elek fled. The passage was steep and narrow, and it ended before a blank wall. Behind him, a steady padding of feet grew louder in the distance. He felt around desperately in the dark. If there was a hidden spring in the walls, he failed to find it. A grin lighted his face as he realized how narrow the passage was. If he could do it... He placed his palms flat against the wall, and with his bare feet found an easy purchase on the opposite one. Face down, swiftly, with his muscles cracking under the strain, he walked up the wall until he was safely above the head of even the giant. There he stopped, sweating, and glanced down. Only an enormously strong man could have done it, and if Elek had weighed a little more, it would have been impossible. His shoulders and thighs ached as he strained to hold his position without moving. The trio were approaching. If they should glance up, Elek was ready to drop and use his blade or the strange weapon Jesty had given him. But apparently they did not notice him, hidden as he was in the shadows of the high ceiling. He caught a glimpse of the girl the giant carried, a luscious wench. But of course, Zend would undoubtedly choose only the most attractive maidens for his necromancy and sorcery. "If that dead alive monster weren't here," he ruminated, "I'd be tempted to fall on Zend's head. No doubt the girl would be grateful." She was, at the moment, unconscious. Long black lashes lay on cream-pale cheeks, and dark ringlets swayed as the giant lurched on. Zen's hand fumbled out, touched the wall. The smooth surface of stone lifted, and the gray dwarf pattered into the dimness beyond. The giant followed, and the door dropped again. With a low curse of relief, Elek swung noiselessly to the floor and rubbed his hands on his leather tunic. They were bleeding, and only the hardness of his soles had saved his feet from a similar fate. After a brief wait, Elek fumbled in the darkness and found the concealed spring. The door lifted with a whispering rush of sound. Elek found himself in a short corridor that ended in another black-slashed silver curtain. He moved forward, noticing with relief the door remained open behind him. Beyond the silver curtain was a room, huge, high-domed, with great open windows through which the chill night wind blew strongly. The room blazed with the coruscating brilliance of the glowing gems, which were set in walls and ceiling in bizarre arabesque patterns. Through one window, Elek saw the yellow globe of the moon, which was just rising. Three archways, curtained, broke the smooth expanse of the farther wall. The chamber itself, richly furnished with rugs and silks and ornaments, was empty of occupants. Alec noiselessly covered the distance to the archways and peered through the curtain of the first. Blazing white light blinded him. He had a flashing, indistinct vision of tremendous forces, leashed, cyclopean, straining mightily to burst the bonds that held them. Yet, actually, he saw nothing. Merely an empty room. But empty he knew it was not. Power unimaginable surged from beyond the archway, shuddering through every atom of Alec's body. Glittering steel walls reflected his startled face. And on the floor, in the very center of the room, he saw a small mud-colored stone. That was all. Yet about the stone surged a tide of power that made Alec drop the curtain and back away, his eyes wide with fear. Very quickly, he turned to the next curtain, peered apprehensively beyond it. Here was a small room, cluttered with alembics, retorts, and other of Zen's magical paraphernalia. The pallid giant stood silently in a corner. On a low table was stretched the girl, still unconscious. Above her hovered the gray dwarf, a crystal vial in one hand. He tilted it. A drop fell. Alec heard Zen's harsh voice. "A new servant. A new soul to serve me. When her soul is freed, I shall send it to Antares. There is a planet there where I've heard much sorcery exists. Mayhaps I can learn a few secrets." Alec turned to the last alcove. He lifted the curtain, saw a steep stairway. From it, rose-red light blazed down. He remembered Jesty's words. "Shatter the red sphere. His magic comes from it." Good. He'd break the sphere first, then, with no magic to protect him, Zen would be easy prey. With a lithe bound, Alec began to mount the stairs. Behind him came a guttural cry. "Eblis, Ishtar, and Poseidon," Alec said hastily. "Protect me now." It was at the top of the staircase, in a high-domed room through which the moonlight crept from narrow windows. It was the room of the sphere. Glowing, shining with lambent rose-red radiance, the great sphere lay in a silver cradle, metallic tubes and wires trailing from it to vanish into the walls. Half as tall as Alec's body it was, its brilliance soft but hypnotically intense, and he stood for a moment, motionless, staring. Behind him, feet clattered on the stair. He turned, saw the pallid giant lumbering up. A livid scar circled the dead white neck. He had been right then. This was the criminal he had seen executed, brought back to life by Zen's necromancy. In the face of real danger, Alec forgot the gods and drew his rapier. Prayers, he had found, would not halt a dagger's blow or a strangler's hands. Without a sound, the giant sprang for Alec, who dodged under the great clutching paws and sent his rapier point deep within the dead white breast. It bent dangerously. He whipped it out just in time to save it from snapping, and it sang shrilly as it vibrated. Alec's opponent seemed unhurt, yet the rapier had pierced his heart. He bled not at all. The battle was not a long one, and it ended at a window. The two men went reeling and swaying around the room, ripping wires and tubes from their places in the fury of their struggle. Abruptly, the red light of the globe dimmed, went out. Simultaneously, Alec felt the giant's cold arms go about his waist. Before they could tighten, he dropped. The moon peered in at a narrow window just beside him, and he flung himself desperately at the giant's legs, wrenching with all his strength. The undead creature toppled. He came down as a tree falls, without striving to break the force of the impact. His hands went out clutchingly for Alec's throat, but Alec was shoving frantically at the white, cold, muscular body, forcing it out of the narrow window. It overbalanced, toppled, and fell. The giant made no outcry. After a moment, a heavy thud was audible. Alec got up and recovered his rapier, loudly thanking Ishtar for his deliverance. For, he thought, a little politeness cost nothing, And even though my own skill and not Ishtar's hand save me, one never knows. Two, there were other dangers to face, and if the gods are capricious, the goddesses are certainly even more so. A loud shriek from below made him go quickly to the stairway, rapier ready. Zend was running towards him, his grave face a mask of fear. The dwarf hesitated at the sight of him, spun about as a low rumble of voices came from nearby. At the foot of the stairway, Elek waited. From the passage by which Elek had entered the great room, a horde of nightmare beings spewed. In their van came Jesty, gray garments flapping, white face immobile as ever. Behind him, sheer horror squirmed and leaped and tumbled. With a shock of loathing, Elek remembered the whispering voices he had heard in the underground cavern and knew now what manner of creatures had spoken them. A race that had not sprung from human or even earthly loins. Their faces were hideous, staring masks, fish-like in contour, with parrot-like beaks and great staring eyes covered with a filmy glaze. Their bodies were amorphous things, half solid and half gelatinous ooze, like the iridescent slime of jellyfish, writhing tentacles sprouting irregularly from the ghastly bodies of the things. They were the offspring of no sane universe, and they came in a blasphemous, hissing rush across the room. The rapier stabbed out vainly and clattered to the stones as Elek went down. He struggled futilely for a moment, hearing the harsh, agonized shrieks of the wizard. Cold tentacles were all about him, blinding him in their constricting coils. Then suddenly the weight that held him helpless was gone. His legs and arms, he discovered, were tightly bound with cords. He fought vainly to escape, then lay quiet. Beside him, he saw the wizard lay tightly trussed. The nightmare beings were moving in an orderly rush towards the room which Elek had sensed the surges of tremendous power, where lay the little brown stone. They vanished beyond the curtain, and besides Elek and the wizard, there remained only Jesty. He looked down at the two, his white face immobile. "What treachery is this?" Elek asked with no great hopefulness. "Set me free and give me my gold." But Jesty merely said, "You won't need it. You will die very soon." "Eh? Why?" "Fresh human blood is needed. That's why we didn't kill you or Zend. We need your blood. We'll be ready soon." An outburst of sibilant whispers came from beyond the silver drape. Elek said unsteadily, "What manner of demon are those?" The wizard gaped. "You ask him? Did you not know?" Jesty lifted his gloved hands and removed his face. Elek bit his lips to choke back a scream. Now he knew why Jesty's face had seemed so immobile. It was a mask. Behind it were the parrot-like beak and fish-like eyes Elek now knew all too well. The gray robes sloughed off, the gloves dropped from the limber tips of tentacles. From the horrible beak came the sibilant whisper of the monster. "Now you know whom you served." The thing that had called itself Jesty turned and progressed. That was the only way to describe its method of moving. To the curtain behind which its fellows had vanished. It joined them. Zend was staring at Elek. "You did not know? You served them? And yet did not know?" "By Ishtar, no," Elek swore. "Do you think I'd have let those... What are they? What are they going to do?" "Roll over here," Zend commanded. "Maybe I can loosen your bonds." Elek obeyed, and the wizard's fingers worked deftly. "I doubt no human hands tied these knots, but..." "What are they?" Elek asked again. "Tell me before I go mad thinking hell has loosed its legions on Atlantis." "They are the children of Dagon," Zend said. "Their dwelling place is in the great deeps of the ocean. Have you never heard of the unearthly ones who worship Dagon?" "Yes, but I never believed..." "Oh, there's truth to the tale. Eons and unimaginable eons ago, before mankind existed on Earth, only the waters existed.
there was no land, and from the slime there sprang up a race of beings which dwelt in the sunken abysses of the ocean, inhuman creatures that worshipped Dagon, their god. When eventually the waters receded and great continents arose, those beings were driven down into the lowest depths. Their mighty kingdom, that which had once stretched from pole to pole, was shrunken as the huge land masses lifted. Mankind came, but from whence I do not know, and civilizations arose. Hold still, these cursed knots!
I don't understand all of that, Halleck said, wincing as the wizard's nail dug into his wrist, but go on.
These things hate man, for they feel that man has usurped their kingdom. Their greatest hope is to sink the continents again, so that the seas will roll over all the earth, and not a human being will survive. Their power will embrace the whole world as it once did eons ago. They are not human, you see, and they worship Dagon. They want no other god worshipped on earth. Ishtar, Dark Eblis, even Poseidon of the sunlit seas. They will achieve their desire now, I fear.
Not if I can get free, Alex said. How do the knots hold?
They hold, the wizard said discouragedly. But one strand is loose. My fingers are raw.
The red globe is broken?
No, Alex said. Some cords were torn loose as I fought with your slave, and the light went out of it.
Why?
The gods be thanked, Zen said fervently. If I can repair the damage and light the globe again, the children of Dagon will die. That's the purpose of it. The rays it emits destroys their bodies, which are otherwise invulnerable, or almost so. If I hadn't had the globe, they'd have invaded my palace and killed me long ago.
They have a tunnel in the cellars, Alex said.
I see. But they dare not invade the palace while the globe shone, for the light rays would have killed them. Curse these knots! If they accomplish their purpose...
What's that? Alec asked, but he already guessed the answer.
To sink Atlantis! The island continent would have gone down beneath the sea long ago if I hadn't pitted my magic and my science against that of the children of Dagon. They are masters of the earthquake, and Atlantis rests on none too solid a foundation. Their power is sufficient to sink Atlantis forever beneath the sea, but within that room... Zen nodded towards the curtain that hid the sea-bred horrors. In that room there is a power far stronger than theirs. I have drawn strength from the stars and the cosmic sources beyond the universe. You know nothing of my power. It is enough, more than enough, to keep Atlantis steady on its foundation, impregnable against the attacks of Dagon's breed. They have already destroyed other lands before Atlantis.
Hot blood dripped on Alec's hands as the wizard tore at the cords.
Aye, other lands. There were races that dwelt on Earth before man came. My powers have shown me a sunlit island that once reared far to the south, an island where dwelt a race of beings tall as trees, whose flesh was as hard as stone, and whose shape was so strange you could scarcely comprehend it. The waters rose and covered that island, and its people died. I have seen a gigantic mountain that speared up from a waste of tossing waters in Earth's youth, and in the towers and minarets that crowned its summit dwelt beings like sphinxes, with the heads of beasts and gods, and whose broad wings could not save them when the cataclysm came. For ruin came to that city of sphinxes and sank it beneath the ocean, destroyed by the children of Dagon. And there was,
hold! Alec's breathless whisper halted the wizard's voice.
Hold! I see rescue, Zend!
Eh?
The wizard screwed his head around until he, too, saw the short, ape-like features of the man who was running silently across the room, knife in hand. It was Lycan, whom Alec had left slumbering in the underground den of Jesty. The knife flashed, and Alec and Zend were free. Alec said swiftly, "Up the stairs, wizard! Repair your magic globe, since you say its light will kill these horrors. We'll hold the stairway." Without a word, the gray dwarf sped silently up the steps and was gone. Alec turned to Lycan. "How the devil?" Lycan blinked wide blue eyes.
"I scarcely know, Alec.
Only when you were carrying me out of the tavern and the soldier screamed and ran away, I saw something that made me so drunk I couldn't remember what it was. I remembered only a few minutes ago, back downstairs somewhere, a face that looked like a gargoyle's, with a terrible great beak and eyes like Midgard's serpent. And I remembered I'd seen Jesty put on a mask over the awful face just before you turned there in the alley. So I knew Jesty was probably a demon.
And so you came here, Alec commented softly. Well, it's a good thing for me you did. What's the matter? Lycan's blue eyes were bulging. Is that your demon? The little man asked, pointing. Alec turned and smiled grimly. Facing him, her face puzzled and frightened, was the girl on whom Zond had been experimenting, the maiden whose soul he had been about to unleash to serve him when Alec had arrived. Her eyes were open now, velvet soft and dark, and her white body gleamed against the silver-black drape. Apparently she had awakened and had arisen from her hard couch. Alec's hand went up in a warning gesture, commanding silence, but it was too late. The girl said, "Who are you? Zend kidnapped me. Are you come to set me free?" Where, with a bound, Alec reached her, dragged her back, thrust her up the stairway. His rapier flashed in his hand. Over his shoulder he cast a wolfish smile. "If we live, you'll escape Zend and his magic," he told the girl, hearing an outburst of sibilant cries and the rushing murmur of the attacking horde. Yet he did not turn. "What's your name?" he asked.
"Corillus."
"Where, Elak?"
Lycan shouted. Alec turned to see the little man's sword flash out, shearing a questing tentacle in two. The severed end dropped, writhing and coiling in hideous knots. The frightful devil masks of the monsters glared into Alec's eyes. The children of Dagon came sweeping in a relentless rush, cold eyes glazed and glaring, tentacles questing, iridescent bodies shifting and pulsing like jelly. And Alec and Lycan and the girl, Corillus, were caught up by their fearful wave and forced back up the staircase. Snarling inarticulate curses, Lycan swung his sword, but it was caught and dragged from his hand by a muscular tentacle. Alec tried to shield Corillus with his own body. He felt himself going down, smothered beneath the oppressive weight of cold, hideous bodies that writhed and twisted with dreadful life. He struck out desperately, and he felt a hard, cold surface melting like snow beneath his hands. The weight that held him down was dissipating. The things were retreating, flowing back, racing and flopping and tumbling down the stairs, shrieking an insane, shrill cry. They blackened and melted into shapeless puddles of slime that trickled like a little gray stream down the stairway. Alec realized what had happened. A rose-red light was glowing in the air all about him. The wizard had repaired his magic globe, and the power of its rays was destroying the nightmare menace that had crept in from the deep. In a heartbeat, it was all over. There was no trace of the horde that had attacked them. Gray puddles of ooze, no more. Alec realized that he was cursing softly, and abruptly changed it to a prayer, with great earnestness. He thanked Ishtar for his deliverance. Lycan recovered his sword and handed Elak his rapier. "What now?" he asked. "We're off. We're taking Corillus with us. There's no need to linger here. True, we helped the wizard, but we fought him first. He may remember that. There's no need to test his gratefulness, and we'd be fools to do it." He picked up Corillus, who had quietly fainted, and quickly followed Lycan down the steps. They hurried across the great rooms and into the depths of the corridor beyond, and 5 minutes later they were sprawled at full length under a tree in one of Sanmu's numerous parks. Alec had snatched a silken robe from a balcony as he passed beneath, and Corillus had draped it around her slim body. The stars glittered frostily overhead, unconcerned with the fate of Atlantis, stars that would be shining thousands of years hence, when Atlantis was not even a memory. No thought of this came to Elak now. He wiped his rapier with a tuft of grass, while Lycan, who had already cleaned his blade, stood up and, shading his eyes with his palm, peered across the park. He muttered something under his breath and set off at a steady lope.
Alex stared after him. Where's he going? There's a... By Ishtar, he's going into a grog shop. But he has no money. How... A shocked thought came to him, and he felt hastily to his wallet. Then he cursed. That drunken little ape. When he slashed my bonds in the wizard's palace, he stole the purse. I'll... Alex sprang to his feet and took a stride forward. Soft arms gripped his leg. He looked down. Eh? Let him go, Gorilla said, smiling. He's earned his mead. Yes, but what about me? I... Let him go, Corillus murmured. And even after that, Lycan was to wonder why Elec never upbraided him about the stolen purse.
That was Spawn of Dagon by Henry Kuttner, narrated by James Silverstein. Firstly, I'd like to thank James for another great performance. He's generously contributed two previous narrations in episodes 47 and 49, and we have another to look forward to coming very soon. Much appreciated, sir. A lovely reading. As I mentioned last week, I often get a kick out of the artwork that accompanies the stories in their original publishing, but it's the artwork inspired by this whole mythos that grabs me the most. So while I've linked to a digital version of the original magazine so that you can take a look at its artwork for yourself, I've also linked to a Tumblr post I found recently with some particularly striking Cthulhu artwork. I hope you enjoy. We'd love to know what you thought of the story and the artwork. Let us know by leaving a comment on our site at protectingprojectpulp.com or joining the conversation in the District of Wonders forum linked from the site menu. And while you're there, don't forget to subscribe to the show via iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Just click the subscribe link. Thanks for listening from everyone here at PPP. Our assistant editor, Fred Heimbaugh, our sound engineer, Tom O'Dwyer, our producer, Tony C. Smith, and from me, your host, Simon Hildebrand. We hope you'll join us next time for episode 91, where we'll be embarking on a new three-part story, Black Amazon of Mars, by Lee Brackett. Don't forget to thank Ishtar for your deliverance, and have a great week.
This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.